When you're set, Mr. Estabrook, I know you've been set forever. Are you ready to go? We started? Okay. Word is that Libby Roderick's earliest memories of singing were at the top of her lungs to keep the bears away. Later, when the Alaskan child's family moved to India to work in the Peace Corps, she and her sister found themselves without a TV. So they taught themselves all the words to all the tunes from all the American musicals they could remember and sang to entertain themselves. These days, Libby Roderick sings to entertain others and perhaps to help her audience look closely at bears of a different kind. This is Conversations. I'm Susan McGinnis, and I welcome today Libby Roderick, singer, songwriter, and recording artist. Her first album is If You See a Dream, which was produced this year in 1990. Is that true, or is that an Alaskan myth, that when you were a little girl, your earliest memories are singing to keep the bears away?
Oh, no, that's quite true. Quite true. Yeah, down in Homer is what I mostly remember. And my folks would just tell me. I mean, I still do it, you know, as many people do, I guess. And I would walk along, and I remember the grasses that are now, of course, more like waist-high being over my head.
Uh-huh.
And they would just hear me. They'd know where I was because I was out there bellowing away.
So your singing was also a babysitter for your folks.
Yeah, I suspect that there was a dual purpose there. Uh-huh. But I still do it. It still works better than having to yell the whole time. It's just get out there and sing.
Do you remember that you sang an articulated tune?
I don't remember. My guess is I was just making up something, singing to the bears or about the bears or...
Right.
Yeah.
The Peace Corps, at 9 years old, is that the case?
Right. I was 9. My older sister was 11. And my both of my parents were taken, I think, with John Kennedy's asking, what can you do for your country? And so they signed up for the Peace Corps. And because we were children, when my folks were assigned a place, my dad was assigned to India. He was a regional director, meaning that we didn't go into the villages because they wouldn't let young people into the villages because of susceptibility to disease. So we were stationed in Delhi, mm-hmm. New Delhi, and then in Bombay. And it was a good time of life, 9 years old, because I was certainly aware enough to know what was happening. But I wasn't so attached. I wasn't in junior high, and I wouldn't die, you know, if I couldn't be with my friends.
Uh-huh.
And it was quite an impressive year, actually.
It was just a year, 12 months' time.
It was 12 months. The usual stint is 3 years. My father had an injury, and we had to come home early.
What, for an Alaskan child, do you think that experience was different than it might have been for a child raised in a more cosmopolitan environment?
Huh. Well, it was certainly a lot warmer, I have to say. There was a climactic shift. But I wouldn't say so. The impact of it was that their culture is so different and their available resources are so small that the impact, I think, was very profound, and it probably would have been so for me had I come from anywhere in the U.S., which was that I have always known thereafter that how we do it in our country is not the only way,
mm-hmm.
and how we do it in our country often impacts what other people get to have. You know, we have so much, they have so little. And that pretty much stuck with me.
Seeing that as a very young age, do you think that influenced later music, for example, the music on your album?
I think it reinforced a pre-existing tendency to empathize with people who are hurting, you know, or to wish to reach out for or to make equal, you know, people who are underprivileged.
Mm-hmm. And something of the interconnectedness, Libby, with the rest of the world?
Yeah, that's certainly true. And global interconnectedness. I mean, really seeing, at least I felt that was the case, that why some people have less is because some people have too much. I mean, that they're not separate entities.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that we have so many resources in our country, and other countries frequently have so little.
You're listening to Libby Roderick. She has just released in 1990 her first record album, although record albums don't come out as record albums anymore. They come out as CDs and cassette tapes, I noticed. The album is called If You See a Dream. I'm thinking that you had a later reinforcement for this thought of interconnectedness in a very academic and practical way through your studies at Yale.
Yes.
You studied what are called American studies?
Right.
Tell us what that is.
Well, American Studies is a look at our culture, the systems that we live within, the beliefs, the perspectives, the artwork, the history, the literature, why we set up our transportation systems this way, why we have pop culture the way we have it. It's looking kind of at both the outer and inner belief system of a culture and how their inner beliefs get expressed outside of themselves, you know, in a physical way. Mm-hmm. And it's very interdisciplinary, meaning that everything that you look at, you're taught to say, well, what if you looked at this from a historical viewpoint? Well, what if you looked at this from a just the people's viewpoint? Well, what if you looked at it from how they were doing their art? And you see a belief reflected in someone's history, someone's paintings, someone's furniture, somebody's, you know, fences, mm-hmm. how they build their fences or their tombstones, you know, that all your beliefs come out somehow. And we studied all those different ways as opposed to just looking at architecture or just looking at it from history or so on. So what it showed you is that everything is connected, you know, that there is a connection between how, and the connection starts from inside the people and then goes out into the world.
Through our artifacts and our actions.
Right.
Is it possible to give us an example, a belief system, an American belief system, and how it reflects out? That's a complex question, I know.
Yeah, I'd have to think about that for a second.
Okay.
Well, I mean, one of the things that we studied quite a bit then was the folks who came over, the first white folks who came over to the U.S., mm-hmm. And that you would see, I can't bring it to mind honestly right now, but you know, who we call the Puritans and their different beliefs of, for instance, actually believing that divinity was something quite separate from ourselves and quite angry. You know, sinners in the hands of an angry God is an American Puritan sermon. And that as a result, when they would have tombstones, for instance, you know, they would have the pictures on them. Would reflect that belief system, as opposed to later on when you'd see them bury people, they'd have different pictures on their tombstones which reflected a different belief in what was happening in the world. Or when you look at the way they sat in their art, they'd be very rigid and sitting there, you know. And, you know, portraits were not happy things like we have now. Snapshots, we'd have these people sitting very prim and proper and stiff. Mm-hmm. And some of that was because of the painting possibilities then, you know, you didn't have photographs, so you had to sit for a long time. But some of it was also their belief of the worldview, you know, what is happening in this world. We are sinners, and we are sort of suffering through life as a result of our own faults. And so they would reflect that in their paintings and whatnot.
And emotions are constrained appropriately.
Right.
And the intellect follows a certain path appropriately. So
right.
Things were more stable and more rigid then.
In some ways. And then in other ways, when you look back, of course, we have a stereotypical view of who those people are, and they weren't so restrained. I mean, we are in many ways more rigid in mm-hmm. other areas mm-hmm. than they were.
How valuable is it, having done this kind of study, how valuable do you think it is for a culture to be aware of its belief systems through its artifacts, its history reflected in daily life today?
I think it's absolutely critical, particularly because we're now operating in a global community. We are, you know, we are not operating in isolation. The Americans are dealing with the Libyans, and the Libyans are dealing with the Iranians, and, you know, and this matters in a very profound way right now as we're trying to negotiate ways to keep the planet mm-hmm. sustained, you know. Mm-hmm. And it'd be like, you know, the great, I don't know who said it, some Greek philosopher saying, you know, the biggest truth is to know yourself. And that once you know yourself, you know what you're operating with, what your strengths are, what your weaknesses are, where you came from, why you think that. You know, when you can be open to a new view and when you have to absolutely say, no, I know this is true and I cannot budge on this one. Mm-hmm. And until our country knows itself that well, then we're forever kind of weaving in the wind, you know, or reacting to other people, or just like a human is in a social environment, mm-hmm. you know. So I think it's really important because the stakes are pretty high right now.
One of the things you have been doing since 1982 is to lead workshops and consult with companies or with state agencies on various topics. Some of those are business communications, interpersonal communications, styles of relating one to the other, which seems to move out of the topic we were just looking at. where do you think in looking at workshop participants our weaknesses are? Can you make a general statement?
As Americans, you mean?
Sure. You've been working largely in Alaska. I don't know whether it's different or similar to the outside.
Well, that's an interesting question. I'll start with this. Americans are raised in the mythology that we live in a free country. Okay, this is our belief system, which we widely propagandize. Mm-hmm. And in many respects, that's true. You have the ability to speak out against leaders, should you so choose. You know, you have a wide variety of freedoms that in many countries they don't have, and they suffer greatly from not having, and that is certainly true. Then in other ways, I've heard it said, I don't know who said this, but that in the Soviet Union, everybody knows that the government is trying to control them, or the economic forces, the vested in economic interests, will be trying to control them. And it's overt. Everybody knows that. And they know that they're being lied to, that they know that propaganda is propaganda. And so the government doesn't, and that they will be controlled. They will be controlled by force, if need be, to get them to conform. And so nobody believes it. They don't have constrictions in the brain. They know it's lies. They know they have to do it. They know there's force backing it up. So they don't have to try to brainwash them at such a level as in, say, a country where we insist on believing always that we are acting as free agents, that we are not, for instance, at the mercy of economic interests, vested economic interests, or that no one is trying to control us. We have a free media, etc. And as a result, there has to be a very massive brainwashing system in place, because that's simply not true. We are as at the mercy of vested economic interests in this country as any other country is. And one of the primary ways that happens is through advertising. You know, we are constantly bombarded and assaulted in this country with advertising that gives you the idea that you have free choice, mm-hmm. or with the idea that if you pick up the newspaper, you're getting all of the news. You know, all you have to do is go to Europe to discover that that is not the case. We know less in many ways about the world community than many other countries do. And so I think when I work with people, part of what I'm working with is the heavy isolation in this country that comes from the myth that we are all individual agents, that we all have free choice, that when we go into Nordstrom's and we buy that coat, that's a choice, as opposed to the fact that they have, you know, they have given us our choice and we get to pick out of it mm-hmm. every year. This vested economic interest gives you fashion and then we get to choose within it. But the context has been set. The frame has been set, as in the media, they will set the context for questions, we'll debate within it. But nobody ever says, well, hey, that whole frame is off. You know, we don't want to talk about whether we bomb them or not, you know, in a setting about a war. We want to talk about whether this kind of conversation is even worth having. You know, we shouldn't even be thinking about this. And we don't, people don't see those things as much as they do in other countries, I think. They're not aware of the fact that we are, in fact, operating under a frame that somebody else has set as consumers.
And are you of the belief that this is a conspiracy to limit the context of American freedom? Or is it the result of many interests operating, some political, some economic, to in their own interest.
Right.
The Democrats for the Democrats, the Republicans
right,
for
right.
the Republicans, the administration for the administration, Nordstrom's for Nordstrom's.
Right. I don't believe in conspiracy, a conscious conspiracy theory. It never seems to be true, because I often will work with people who are the people who you would think would be the conspirators, you know, the people who are owning class people, the people who have heavy vested interests or who are higher in the political frame, and they're never doing it for that reason.
Mm-hmm.
They have just been more seriously conditioned with that worldview, the worldview that, for instance, one of the myths we have in America is that the best thing to do is to make a profit, that is a good, noble, virtuous thing to pursue. And most men in particular have been very forcefully conditioned into that belief system.
Hmm.
And they will pursue it with all their heart and soul, sincerely, and as good people. I mean, I have no question that people are doing as well as they can, and that they are intending good.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think I've ever met somebody who isn't trying to. But the belief system does not get questioned. You know, if you go to another country, Thailand, for instance, most of the people do not share that particular belief. They're Buddhist, for one thing. And so they have a belief that's centered more around compassion, more around spiritual growth, more around helping others, service, etc. And, you know, we have mandatory, well, we don't now, but military service. They have mandatory go in and be a monk or a nun for a few years, you know, and then you can come out and do something else. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, that's a very different orientation. And in the U.S., we rarely have the opportunity, really, to reflect on how do we want to do this? You know, are these our values? Is this what we really want to do? Mm-hmm. People get conditioned really early into the myths, I think. And I'm not laying blame. I mean, I love this country, and there are a lot of really fantastic things about it, obviously. One of them being the Constitution. But I think that we don't, part of it's geographical. I mean, in Europe, for instance, they're right next to each other. You know, they have to face on a daily basis that their worldview is different from the guy next door, you know. And we, you know, we're pretty geographically isolated. We have Canada and Mexico. And I think being a superpower tends to make it harder for people to see that everybody else's value systems and everybody else's beliefs and everybody else's countries are equal to ours and could be used as a learning experience.
We're listening to Libby Rodrick. She is a singer-songwriter. We're not talking yet about that phase of her life, clearly. Taking a dive into political thinking and some of her academic history. I said at the beginning of this discussion that your music seems to, in some ways, help the audience look closely at bears of a different kind. Mm. It seemed appropriate, and I think it is. Your music talks about domestic violence, about how people see themselves. How could anyone say that you're not beautiful? Mm. The downside of that song feels to me to be to speak to people who were constantly told they were not beautiful. Those who are victims of incest, those who were battered as children or as adult women or men, those who were neglected in their lives, emotionally or physically. I wonder if that reflection is accurate in your mind, if you bring the bears to the stage, you bring the difficult parts of life to the stage and let people look at them. Does that relate in any way to your thinking?
I hadn't thought of it that way, but in terms of internal bears, mm-hmm. I mean, if you view bears as a hard thing, I'm not sure that I do.
Okay.
But
all right.
You know what I mean?
Sure.
Scary to us, certainly. They're right. Scary to us, put it that way. And powerful.
A possible predator.
Right. Yeah. Right, that's right. What I think I'm picturing in the music, what people see, is that I am articulating a struggle, and usually it's my own, mm-hmm. in responding to something I have seen, whether it's my own suffering or hopelessness or whatever, or whether it's somebody else's. And what I'm hoping comes out of the music is the sense of the process, that it is a difficult struggle, but you come out of it on the other side. You know, that there is enormous hope. I have enormous hope for people taking on whatever internal struggle they have and moving through it and transforming it into something really useful to themselves. And I'm not scared of a lot of the hard things in life. And part of that's because I've gone through that struggle.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that in the music, yeah, it'll be articulated a lot, the internal struggle with pain or with hopelessness or with fear, and then the coming through.
This is very clear in Don't Give Up.
Yes.
Which was written in response or inspired, you say, by an annual End Violence Against Women and Children Speak Out.
Yes. In Anchorage and elsewhere, they have annual times for women who have been victims of violence, and of course that includes most women, I think, on some level, whether that's emotional or physical or sexual violence. Where they get a chance to speak out in a fairly intimate setting in terms of articulating what has happened to them so that it's no longer something they hold alone to themselves, and it's something that they can take pride in, the fact that they have fought back from the impact of that. And we have a speak out, and I was asked to sing, and the song Don't Give Up came from my experience that the darkness, you know, is worse just before the dawn, and that, you know, if you're feeling really terrible about this, hang in there just a little while longer. It'll
mm-hmm.
break.
Mm-hmm. Your album has been called folk. I don't find it folk. I'm not sure what I find it, which is interesting to me. I was listening again to it, to the CD this morning, and thinking, well, yes, I can hear folk influence here, but there are a couple of very clearly country pieces. Coming Home,
yes.
There's no doubt about it. This is an unadulterated love song. This is a country love song.
Right.
And there's another one that's not...
If You See a Dream.
If You See a Dream,
right.
Yes,
mm-hmm.
is very country.
Right.
There is a meditative piece or two. Mm-hmm. The unaccompanied body is the temple. I see also Grandfather Son as a meditative mm-hmm. piece. We'll talk about both of those as we go along here. And then there's a bit of
jazz,
marimba
gospel.
Music
right,
going on.
Right.
With that range, how does Libby Roderick see Libby Roderick's music?
Well, I have been, the industry in particular, and listeners, when you haven't heard a piece of music, you want somebody to kind of put it in a ballpark.
Is this jazz?
Right. What is this, you know? Right. And I don't know what it is, to be honest. And I think many, many artists these days in particular are doing what they call crossover music, where, you know, you're pulling from a whole, it's like being an interdisciplinary major in college, you know, you pull from all over. And that seems inherent to me. I would be terribly bored if I was only writing country music, you know, or it doesn't seem to express the different moods that I would have, or, you know, the different feelings of a message I'm getting across wouldn't fit, you know, in the same genre. So I call it folk. I usually say it's under the umbrella of folk, but it includes all of these styles, mm-hmm. jazz, gospel, Native American, whatever. And I do that only because it's acoustic music. And people don't often know what that means. You know, if it's not electric music, it's not rock and roll, it's not heavy metal. You know, there's a certain realm that it isn't. It's more internal, it's more closer to the earth in the sense that you're using instruments that are wooden or string, mm-hmm. you know, not plugged in. And so I don't know what to call it either.
Does music more than any other form of articulation allow you to speak to your politics or speak to the movements of your spirit or the movements of your intellect or emotions in a way that other possibilities don't?
It does. It does for me. It's similar to dance. It's a very physical experience. I actually experience physical energy passing through my body, which is a sort of a spiritual experience, you know. I actually was doing political work or social change work, however you want to call it, for quite a number of years until I burnt out, as many people do. I was exhausted, I was frustrated, I was beat, you know. And it took me a couple years to discover that I needed to do my social change work from a place that fed me. Mm-hmm. And when I need to be fed, I go to music. I love music, you know. Music is like being on the wings of the wind to me. And so I get to, in this way, integrate a bunch of things. One is the political aspect, one is the poet aspect, and then one is this great, you know, gift from the heavens, which is music to me. I read a book once where they called it the language of the emotions, so I guess it does, you know, integrate the emotional with the intellect, which is the poetic part with the political and the, mm-hmm. the spiritual. So,
and is it easier to reach people through music than through another form of articulation?
I think music is where people are open emotionally. It is the language of the emotions. You're speaking heart to heart rather than head to head, although the head's engaged. Mm-hmm. I think it's a fairly balanced. It's also a private. A person can do as they like with it. They have their own emotional experience. It may be the same as mine. It may not be. I never really know what people are responding to in a song. I only know that I went very deep inside myself to find it, to what I'm offering. And so what I have found is that many, many people, of course, down in the middle there were pretty much the same, mm-hmm. you know. So they're resonating from their own struggle and their own heart. And what I have hoped is that it will lead to action. The challenge always, I think, for a social change musician is that you don't only want to touch somebody's heart. You're hoping that then their heart will spark their action. And I had one great success once. I have a song called Money. It's not on the album, but it's a... light song about where we invest our money, you know, in the world, about socially responsible investment funds, mm-hmm. you know. And I thought, there's no way in hell that I'm going to go out and preach to people about socially responsible investment funds. But so I did a song called Do You Know Where Your Money Is Tonight? And the result that came from that was two people who I got word back from had gone out to their banks, shifted their money. And I thought, right on, you know, that it was an emotional experience, but it carried beyond. And you always kind of hope that, at least for a few people, that'll happen.
And this is what you're saying very directly when you're talking about if you see a dream. Mm. If you see a dream, for God's sake, dream one. If you can be a hero, for God's sake, be one.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Actually, it's if you see a dream, for God's sake, free it, isn't it?
No, if you're holding someone.
Oh, yeah, if you have a prisoner, let her go.
Right. For God's sake, free her.
Yeah, that song, I went and saw, actually, one of your singers here, Susan Grace, was down in Anchorage. She was singing at a little cafe, and she was singing environmental music, as she does, and it was very moving, and I went home. She was also singing music about Alaska, and, you know, I've been here my whole life, and I'm very deeply heartfelt about the earth, the environment. I went home, I thought, God, you know, I've been here my whole life, you know, I feel this way. Well, I haven't written a song about this at all. And I've tried it before, and it's been too big. It's like too big of a love. Often my biggest loves, I can't quite get that near to write a song about them. And so I went home, and I sat there with myself, and I thought, where I start with music is right inside of my heart. I'm putting my hand here, you know, is that I find, where am I on a deepest level that I can get? Where am I around this? What's my response to this? And I went home and I sat there thinking, you know, I should be writing. Oh, I love the mountains. Oh, you know, and I thought, no, it's not where I am, you know. And where I was hopeless, which I think a lot of people resonate to around the feel, our feelings about the environment. We feel very much like we want it to be right. And it's big, you know, we're dealing on a big scale right now. And I sat there and felt hopeless. And the initial piece of that song is coming from that place of telling how I feel about it. And then, as I do, when I sit with hopelessness and I let it be and I let it express itself, particularly with other people, if possible, it shifts. Yes. It transforms itself. And that's where that chorus comes out. If you see a dream, for God's sakes, free it. If you see a hope, help it grow. You know, if you can be a hero, for God's sakes, be one. And that's, it just shifted into that place of saying we can do something individually. It does really make a difference. Collective individual actions make a humongous difference. And any number of people, I mean, Rosa is another song about individual women, black women in this case, who have made a difference by making a decision to do something. And it may not have solved all of the problems. I mean, I think we get stopped on the environment. I certainly have, by the feeling that, well, if I do this, so it'll help this little corner, but what difference does that make? It makes a difference, and it inspires other people to continue in their actions.
The story, I don't know whether you know it, of the little boy who was plucking the dying starfish off the beach and throwing them back into the ocean. Oh. And someone came and said, why are you doing this? I mean, they're dying and beached things everywhere. You're never going to get them all back in. And he said, well, it'll help. Mm-hmm. He tosses one back in and one back in.
It helps us. Mm-hmm. I mean, we do. I do it as much for myself as for, you know, I pick up aluminum cans everywhere. I have a thing in the back of my car and pick them up. And you know, I mean, I do feel the interconnection, like with the earth or with animals or with other people. And it helps me to act on that connection rather than to try to say, well, just because I can't save every child, I'm not going to try to give a hand to my neighbor's kid. You know, that's kind of a strange view. Mm-hmm. I mean, it would be a pretty unhappy life to lead.
Think globally, act locally.
Yeah.
Comes through in that way.
Yeah. Well, it's really literally true that if everybody was to act locally, the globe would be terrific. So there really, I guess the other piece is, I've thought about this quite a lot, there really is no other option. Mm-hmm. You have to act where you are. You can't act anywhere else. You know, so it's going to happen that way.
I have, as you've just mentioned, I've noticed in your songs, and I was looking a moment ago for a couple of examples, but several examples where hopelessness in the lyric is combined with great hope. There's something about My Heart Is on the Street Tonight in a song that is otherwise very uplifting, very bright, very hopeful. Is it your belief that we have to, if you'll forgive me saying it again, look closely at the bear in order to see the possibilities?
I think so. There's a woman who was very helpful in my thinking around this, Joanna Macy, who has a book out actually called Despair and Empowerment in the Nuclear Age. And I remember I used to do a lot of work in anti-nuclear circles, and I was feeling quite overwhelmed, as anyone would. Anyone with any kind of mental health these days, you look out at the world, it's not in the best of shape, you know, let's face it. And I think, you know, the alternative is denial. You're either going to come up against some feelings of hopelessness and overwhelm and work through them, or you're going to have to go into denial.
Do Nordstrom's, do work, do the family,
right.
And that's it.
Shut down. And I don't blame people for doing that. It's without support, it's kind of tough to take on, you know, hopelessness. I think you got to see the light somewhere out there that you're going to get through. But her point was she had been doing work around global issues and found herself. She was a professor of comparative religion at Berkeley, and she'd been doing work with people on environmental issues and social issues, and found herself one day in a fetal position in her office that she could not get out of. I mean, absolutely, in what, you know, many people would say, oh, she's severely depressed or whatever. You know, she was really, really protecting herself and couldn't get out of it. And fortunately, I think, instead of doing what most people do, and particularly most women do, which would be to invalidate it and say, I'm sick, something's wrong with me, I shouldn't be feeling like this, you know, snap out of it. All the American things we say to ourselves to get back to the optimism that progress is on the way, you know, technology will solve it all. She didn't. She took it seriously, which, again, most women are conditioned not to do that for ourselves, to say, this is real, it must be real, I'm feeling it, something's wrong here. And out of that pivotal incident, she and then a host of other people in tandem with her developed a series of workshops on despair and empowerment. And what they began to do was deal with the taboo that people feel, the fear that they feel of saying how I really feel. I really feel some despair around what's happening here, or I really don't know if we're going to make it. You know, that's what we're harboring inside ourselves, too scared to say it for fear it'll come true, for fear other people will say, oh, come on, you know, cheer up, or don't be a party pooper, or, you know, all this stuff. And so we never tap into, when you let that be true, it's a real healthy response, that response, and share it with people who are supportive and who can also then break through enough to say, well, actually, you know, I often feel that way myself. You begin to discover that it's a connectedness experience, that the reason you feel that way is because you are connected to the earth, and the earth is in trouble, you know, or you're connected to people, and a lot of people are hurting these days, and, you know, you're connected to the folks across the globe, and a lot of people are in trouble. And when you see that, it's a real possibility to say, something is wrong here. You know, we can change something. Things aren't working very well. We need to do something about them. And I'm not alone in this, and I'm right, you know. And then the hope comes. Then you find the real power to do something. But as long as you're saying everything's terrific, I mean, it's like they say in alcoholic families or whatever, as long as you're saying, no problem, Dad's drunk every night, you know, that's not a problem. We don't have a problem in this house. Then the hope is very small that anything will be done, you know, anything positive. It's when at least one person says, whoa, I'm not going to keep saying I'm wrong. I'm going to go get some help. I'm going to say, geez, I feel horrible. Something's wrong here. And as long as somebody doesn't come in and say, well, it's your own fault, which is what happens to a lot of people, you know, well, then go back and be nicer to your dad, you know, people can break out. But until they get through that denial, until they admit that something is wrong here, then we don't have the power to change it.
So it's required to not only admit to, but examine the elephant in the living room and perhaps despair of ever getting it out of the living room before you can begin to seek ways to get it out.
Seems to be true. And I think the more that people talk about things like despair and the elephant in the living room or the elephant in the nation, you know, or what have you, people don't have to go down so far. They don't have to say, I am all alone, there is no hope. They say, gee, I feel horrible too. And I heard that lady on the radio, she said she felt horrible and that it was mentally healthy, you know. You know, the more that we talk about it, people don't have to go down so far into that despair. They know they've been feeling it, they hear other people have, they hook up with some support and move.
I'm not nuts. Terminally depressed.
Right.
Permanently aberrant.
Tons of people I know are depressed. I mean, really, when you start talking honestly with your friends and neighbors and circles, an amazing number of people are having a hard time. And I don't think that that's sick, you know? I think it's hard times right now.
You think it speaks to larger issues?
What's happening, yeah. And I think that it's when we tell each other, you know, I'm not feeling too good, and your friend says, well, instead of saying, well, you know, hope you get better, click, you know, I'm fine. They say, well, you know, last week I wasn't feeling that great either. What will come out of that is validation, and that often you don't get as depressed because you're not alone.
But it's fascinating, not to belabor this point, but how little we like that. When I walked in today, I said, hi, Libby, how are you? You said, fine, thanks, how are you? And I said, fine.
Right. That's American. Now, apparently, I just read that it's either, I think it's European, where they, Eastern European, where they will say awful.
Hi.
Every time they see each other, they'll say, hi, how are you? Awful. How are you? Awful. And they mean it the same way we do, which is no one's really telling how are you really. They just have a standard sort of bummed out pattern in Eastern Europe with some historical basis, you know. And we have a standard optimistic everything's terrific pattern in America with some historical basis as well. You know, we've had a pretty successful material history, white folks here. So the point is that there's not a lot of space the way our system is now set up to say, how are you really? You know, you have to have late nights with somebody over coffee or, how, you know, you get these little times when you get together and actually tell the truth. But partly, you know, why I would say
that. Or you burst out to a close friend and say, pardon me, but it's just right. wretched, and I'm going to give you 5 minutes of it.
Right.
And you're going to respond appropriately,
please. I've saved this up for 2 years, and now I'm going to tell somebody.
Because right. you really asked, you fool.
Right.
We're talking today with Libby Rodrick about a range of things. She is a singer, songwriter. She has, for a fairly young adult life, I think she will not mind that being said, involved herself in a wide range of professions, graduating from Yale University in 1981, summa cum laude, Phi Beta Kappa, in American Studies. She has worked in the print media as a reporter, in television also as a reporter. She has helped to produce television documentaries for the Justice Center at the University of Alaska Anchorage, worked in Native issues, done work, as she mentioned a moment ago, in the anti-nuclear effort, and since 1982 has been self-employed as a writer and as a consultant and workshop leader, and most recently has created a record album, a CD and a cassette tape called If You See a Dream. It came out in 1990. You are what people will call, and there are bold quotation marks here, an avowed or a self-avowed feminist, which always amuses me. It seems to me that feminism, despite what many will say, has a definition that differs with the individual. It also has a definition that will differ with the audience. Those people who may or may not think of themselves as feminists but are listening
right.
to someone else describe themselves as feminists.
Right.
In that interest, would you tell me what you think feminism is for Libby Rodrick?
Okay. I do get this question a lot because people have different understandings of the word.
Sure.
I'm glad you asked. Well, I am a woman, pretty obviously. And I write from inside of myself. I have no other way of writing. I mean, I'm certainly not going to write from inside of somebody else. And so I am drawing on my own experiences, my own thoughts, my own feelings, my own history, etc. And that history is influenced every day on every basis by the fact that I'm a female in this culture. And females have different experiences, different things happen to them. People treat them differently. People expect different things from them, etc. So as far as I'm concerned, my whole life has been profoundly impacted by the fact that I am a female. And so I also love myself. After many years of work, I do. And as a result, it's hard for me to imagine valuing. I mean, I don't see I have any choice but to be a feminist, because I think when you love yourself, a couple things, and you're a female, you'll notice a couple things. One is that people don't treat you with very high value. Frequently, this will happen to you. And they also don't treat other women with the value that we have, our inherent value. And if you love yourself, at least my experience has been that you will then think something's wrong with this picture and something needs to be done about it. And my experience has been that that is what feminism is at its most basic place, is that female people who value themselves or have made the struggle enough to think that they're worth something begin to notice that they aren't treated like that in a whole range of ways. I mean, whether it's that they're not paid as much or that they're attacked on the streets or that they're attacked in the home or what have you, you know, that they'll notice that this is not the way that people, valuable people, should be treated. And so I start from that place, which is a very personal place. And I also think that feminism, my understanding of feminism, has to do with valuing all forms of life equally, that all forms of life, whether they are four-legged, two-legged, you know, have only one leg, whatever, you know, are equally valuable. They may have different skill levels, experience levels, different cultural backgrounds, different educational levels, but they are all inherently equally valuable. And this includes women, women being half of the world's people. And that, so feminism is a political theory, really, of equality of all forms of life, with a predominant focus on women, which, as I said, is half of the world. So I don't see it as a special interest, you know, when people say women's issues and they act as if that's some kind of a special interest group. We're talking half of the world, and that every issue that impacts a woman impacts children and men as well. So we're really just talking about everybody. And I think that part of the difficulty the feminist movement runs into is a couple things. One is that there are, in the discovery process of women getting together and discovering that, in fact, a lot of women think that they're valuable and they aren't being treated that way and something needs to change here, there were a couple mistakes made, historically speaking, in what we call the feminist movement. Mm-hmm. And one of them was attacking and blaming men. And I think that that scared so many women and so many men. I don't blame the feminist movement. It was an honest mistake. I think that when women began to discover that something was hurting them, what they saw was it's coming through men. And so they took them on. And I think people got hurt in the process, and I think that's starting to be corrected. I don't myself believe that men are to blame for women's problems. I think sexism is to blame, and that both men and women are saturated with it. They're taught it. They're conditioned in it. They learn it, and then they practice it. But I think that that's part of the reason why everyone's a little bit edgy around, you know, what do you mean you're a feminist? You know, are you going to attack homemakers? Does this mean that, you know, all this kind of stuff? Are you going to attack men? Do you hate men? You know, all this. That's the fear running. And I don't have any of that. I mean, I'm totally proud to be a feminist, and I'm totally behind men, you know, getting what they need, and I'm totally behind women who have chosen traditional options. I also think globally, there's no way around the fact that you have to see that women are in many cases, slave positions in the world, in terms of economics, in terms of sexual choice, you know, whether they have to be sexual with somebody or not, in terms of violence against them. And that feminism addresses those, and I'm all behind it. I mean, if I was over in India, if I had been born in India, that would be happening to me. And it's real clear to me that.
To what extent do you think feminist values have integrated into mainstream society? Or, if you don't, to what extent do you think we have deflected them because of a fear that everything's going to change if you let women in equally?
Mm-hmm. I think we've made terrific progress in the West. For instance, in the U.S., I think there's common acceptance of the idea that women should be equal, or women sort of are equal. Theoretically, I mean, I think that that idea has been widespread. I'm not saying everybody has it. They do not, clearly. But the concept is intact, just much as the concept is now sort of intact that blacks are equal, you know, whether the practice lags behind, which it does, mm-hmm. seriously. But that is progress in and of itself. And there's been a lot of progress made sometimes on the books and whatnot, legally. But I think in practice, it's going to take pretty deep internal work, and I guess this is where, the music focuses on internal shifts that people have to make against their own internal bearers, you know. For a man to not feel threatened by women gaining, he needs to see what he's gaining, you know. And that comes internally. For men to gain, they have to give up a lot of the conditioning they've gotten to be competitive and to be number one and to be, you know, on top all the time and in control of everything and not have feelings, which is not his fault that he got taught that, but he got taught it if he's a man, mostly. And it'll feel very scary. It's like going backwards, you know. I'm going to have to share something. I'm going to have to not compete. I'm going to have to find my feelings. Oh, my God, you know. There's so much conditioning to say, this is scary. You're going to get hit here. You're going to get, other men are going to come smash you if you are a sissy, you know. I mean, just all that fear around women, reclaiming their power. I mean, to get the balance back, women are going to move into power, and men are going to learn the power of vulnerability. And that's a scary thing, you know. Women feel this upsurge of, oh, great, I'm seeing new options, I'm seeing these things, you know. And I think for men, it's the feeling, and I have had it myself, for instance, working against my own racism. You have to give up being the privileged person. Mm-hmm. And that's scary. Fact is, you know. So I think that the work, and then women, I do a lot of workshops with women that are focused on getting rid of our internalized depression, because a lot of times we learn the oppression as early girls, and then we just run it on ourselves and on each other. And a man could be in the room or not, you know, and they don't have to attack us at all. We're going to do it ourselves. And so a lot of the work is on us changing our own internal structures. And that work remains to be done widely.
That split between being able to articulate intellectual values of equality and still keep your head bowed and not ask for too much. And
right. Or, you know, a good example, too, is that women will attack other women leaders. This has happened all the way through the women's
movement. She's not appropriate.
Right. She's not good enough. She's this. She's that. She's too masculine. She's not masculine enough. She's too loud. She's too quiet. She's, you know, what we're running on is she's not a perfect woman. We have in our idea that, you know, she, as a woman, she's got to be just so, you know, and she's not fulfilling whatever we have decided that is.
Is that the basis for songs like When I Hear Music? And there is a line somewhere about women needing a new mythology.
Inspire me.
Inspire me.
Well, it's somewhat the basis. Those songs are against internalized depression for women. Women receive so many messages on a daily basis, as do men, but it's different, in the media that we are, you know, objects or just sexual, or our appearance is what really matters, or that we're kind of stupid or we're too emotional. You know, all you do is just get sort of dumped on constantly, or that we're not even involved. You know, when you look at political world or economic programs, often women aren't even there, you know, being asked what they think. And so I think that women need to keep noticing and claiming what we do. What we do. We do phenomenal now. Women maintain half the world, you know, and often it is in doing things like raising children, which, because women do it, the world doesn't value and doesn't talk about and doesn't appreciate that much. And it's, you know, as you probably know, is a stunning job, and it is probably the key job in the world, because you're raising people, you know, and that's, if people are in good shape, the world goes well. If people are in bad shape, the world goes pretty poorly. So a lot of the songs that I write are about holding up my value for women and saying, look what we do, or look at what these women have done, or, you know, inspire me about, we need to see women who are being bold and daring and taking risks. And some of them are the women, as I mentioned in there, who are managing to raise 5 kids, and they have a smile on their face. I mean, that woman is stunning to me. Stunning. I mean, a woman who raises 1 child these days, it's tough, really tough. And they're amazing women, single moms. You know, to me, single moms are pretty close to God. You know, that's tough. Mm-hmm. It's tough work. And or like I say, you know, a woman who leaves a battering home. What greater courage, really, comes out of anybody? Ever. And is she in a history book? No, she will never be, probably by name, you know. But that's happening all the time, these sort of acts of daily heroism that are profoundly affecting the social fabric of our lives, and women don't get enough recognition. And I think it's really true. I've heard people say that if you don't tell your story, you kind of don't exist, you know, that you can fade into non-existing by not expressing, telling your tale. You know, and I think we need to tell those tales from a positive viewpoint rather than what the woman might hear, which is that you're a failure. You know, you married a guy who hit you, and you've got 5 kids, and you're struggling along, and you're trying to get them on the bus, and they're fussing, and everybody's looking at you like, can't you get your kids under control? Mm-hmm. That's what they see. I'm a failure. God, I'm fat. You know, I can't do anything right. And, you know, I feel like we need in big ways to hold up to these women what they really are doing, which is pretty phenomenal.
And encourage them to find their voice.
Yes. And if they can't find it right now because they got 5 little kids, then I will give it to them. You know, I don't have kids. I mean, I see myself that way many times as somebody who, you know, they call them cultural activists or whatever, something like that. That it is the role of somebody who has the slack, as I do, and happens to have the gifts or the skills to assist people. And I don't do it from a place of feeling like they need it and I'm going to do it for them. But it helps me. I see those women, too, and it could be me. You know, I guess that's always my realization.
And you have the time to be the mirror.
Yeah.
You're listening to Conversations. I'm Susan McInnes. My guest today is singer-songwriter Libby Rodrick. After the oil spill in the Prince William Sound, Exxon Valdez disgorging itself. You wrote a song called Cradle of Dawn. I want to know about that song, because to me it is a lullaby, and it seems to be a lullaby to another nation. Okay. You're nodding.
Yes. Well, I'm glad that you see it as a lullaby. That's exactly what it is. When the Exxon Valdez did its thing, I went into shock. I went into a fetal position. I mean, we're talking literally here. I could barely function. Part of that coming from being born and raised up here and sustaining the myth that this will never happen to me. You know, I'd never even dreamed that something like this could happen. And it was about as crushing as it could be. And I was unable to stop imagery day and night of wildlife dying. And I knew at a certain point that I was becoming exhausted and that I wouldn't be of any use to anybody if I didn't get any rest. And I couldn't shut down this trauma. And so I began to think, what is going to work here? I mean, I called Joanna Macy. I called, you know, I was calling people saying, I need some help. And what occurred to me was that I know some people in Australia and New Zealand who I had met fairly recently who are also dedicated to social justice, to environmental health, and that I knew that those people were devoting their lives in part to preventing such Holocaust from happening in the world, and that the way that I could go to sleep at night was that I knew that when I am laying down at night, they are getting up. And that literally what I was doing was, and it's called Cradle of Dawn because as the sun goes around the globe, you know, we can rest in it. And as I get up, they can go to sleep and whatnot. And it helped. I would cry and cry and cry about that song, and then I could actually go to sleep. So it's kind of a love song to activists, you know, around the world, the idea that we can rest in each other's arms when we need some sleep, which we do. I mean, I'm very profoundly aware of the fact that as leaders, we need a couple things. One is we need to be very close to each other because you can't do this kind of stuff alone. And another is that you need rest. You know, you can't sacrifice yourself to the cause or you end up with a mess of a person joining everybody else, you know.
And the other thing that's operating, at least within the genre, if you will, of lullabies, is that most lullabies speak of difficulties outside the cradle. They rockabye baby, the cradle will fall.
Yes, yes.
They're almost always terrors or disturbances from without, and what you speak of directly in Cradle of Dawn, which is resting from the struggles of the day, the difficulties.
That's interesting. Well, I sure needed it. So it's essentially a lullaby to myself. But
you spent quite a bit of time, it seems to me, in the early 80s working on Native Alaskan issues. Mm-hmm. What prompted?
You know, I don't know. I guess just because that's probably where the stuff was happening. You know, I mean, those issues are such critical issues in terms of a culture and in terms of the land and a whole people that was struggling for their basic rights. And I guess I was just drawn over that direction.
I'm curious, in part because of Grandfather's Son,
yes.
Which is a small anthem to traditional Native American values and their place. Can you?
Yeah. Well, that song came out of a conference I attended. I got a call early in the morning one day from a friend saying, "You got to come down here to this conference," and it was a conference on alcoholism and recovery from it. And some folks from Canada, the Four Worlds Council, were doing a workshop on melding traditional Native American ways of healing with Western ways in approaching alcoholism. And I heard this man talking about a bunch of different things, and one of them was an Indian system of time in which they referred to grandfather's son as that women follow the cycle of the moon and men follow the cycle of the sun on a yearly basis, and they refer to the sun as grandfather's son. He also said that when you want to pray for somebody who is in deep despair, potentially suicidal, etc., that you do so in the quarter of the season cycle prior to when you want the healing to happen. And this was at winter solstice, and most suicides happen in the spring.
April.
Yeah. So it just felt appropriate to write a prayer at winter solstice for people who might be having a hard time in the spring. And so it's called Grandfather Son, and it is about coming out of despair or, you know, the experience of despair. And also, he had said, we can't afford to lose even one person, you know, Native person in this case. But, and it's absolutely right. And so it was written just from a place of solidarity with, you know, those people, the Native American people have been through more than people should ever be asked to go through. Cultural losses, family losses, losses to alcoholism, to TB, you know, not having the right to define their lives. I mean, it's just unbelievable. To me, I stopped writing about Native issues because my heart was breaking.
Too much.
And so I just wanted to respond. That's, it's essentially a prayer to me, that song.
What's next?
For me?
Yeah. As I mentioned a minute or two ago, you've had a broad, for a 32-year-old woman, you have a broad career range, also broad life experience range. Are there dreams for the remainder of the 30th decade, for the 40th and the 50th, or are we that far yet?
I don't think very far in the future. I honestly don't.
Uh-huh. Is there another record album somewhere?
Yeah, I'm sure there probably is. I have enough material to do it. The money, you know, it's a fairly big investment. But eventually I probably will do that. I'd like to take some time out, and it might be, I've been thinking of designing, you can design your own PhD program at this school that I found, and I don't know if I would do that or not, but doing some more time out, time to really reflect and do some writing around issues pertaining to sex roles, which interests me a great deal, and creativity. So I might do that. I'm certainly going to travel when I get the bucks, you know. I'll go somewhere, Africa, I would like. But I don't tend to think particularly far in advance.
Eons in advance. Mm-hmm. Music, always?
Always.
Do you think?
I don't see how I would not have it. It's really, to me, you know, the song I wrote, When I Hear Music, that's where it came from. There's a chorus in there, you know. It sustains me. It is, to me, it's really contact with whatever soul I have. You know, something coming through. It's wonderful.
Libby Rodrick, it's been a pleasure. I'm Susan McInnes. You've been listening to Conversations. My guest today, Libby Rodrick, singer-songwriter, Alaskan. Thanks for joining me.
Thank you.